"What have you picked up?" he asked. When they described Lost, he frowned and said, "That's never going to work." He argued it was just another crazy Abrams project. He and Iger frequently criticized Alias as needlessly complicated and faulted them for coddling Abrams. On another occasion, Eisner gave Braun and Lynn a list of the pilots they'd ordered, on which he'd graded them on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst. Eisner gave Lost a 2. Finally, the new pilot script was done. Braun and Lynn thought it was brilliant, but the price tag for the 2-hour episode, which involved staging an elaborate plane crash, was a whopping $12 million. Braun persuaded Abrams to make a 2-hour pilot so that if it didn't work as a series, they'd still have a made-for-TV movie for their money. He and Lynn did everything they could just to keep production moving forward. "If we're pregnant enough, they won't shut us down," Braun argued. At the same time, he realized that he was living dangerously. If Eisner or Iger decided they wanted to get rid of him, he'd handed them the ammunition. He had green-lit a $12 million pilot that didn't even have a script. Pixar's surprise announcement that it was withdrawing from talks with Disney lent new urgency and momentum to Comcast's planning for a bid for Disney. As Jobs had intimated in his phone conversation with Roy, perhaps new management at Disney, unburdened of the strained Eisner-Jobs relationship, could salvage a Pixar deal. On Thursday, February 5, 2004, the Comcast board met over dinner to discuss a formal bid for Disney. By now, there had been numerous discussions between Mitchell and the intermediary. In a 1-hour presentation, Roberts and Burke emphasized that this was a unique opportunity, since it was unlikely that any of the other major entertainment companies would ever be for sale. He also stressed that after years of investment in broadband technology, the cable systems were now in a position to profit from entertainment content, especially by offering video on demand and creating new cable channels. A major issue was how much it made sense for Comcast to pay for Disney. The film library, the cable channels, and especially ESPN offered major synergies to the cable operators. The theme parks, none. And it probably would have pained Eisner to know that Comcast valued the ABC network at zero. Based on this analysis, Comcast felt it could get to the mid-20s per share, but not much higher. Brian Roberts summed up, lending his support to the merger on the right terms and the right price, and the board gave its unanimous approval to move forward. But in a surfeit of caution, on Thursday, February 6th, Comcast again reached out to Mitchell. After all, at this juncture, there had been two intermediaries positioned between the Comcast executives and Mitchell himself. This kind of telephone approach was not only unorthodox, but inevitably risked a misunderstanding. This time the intermediary called Mitchell from the Davis-Polk offices in New York. Hirsch told the Comcast executives that he had conveyed the message. "We're coming. Are you sure?" Mitchell, through the intermediary, had answered, "Yes, we want you to do this." On Monday afternoon, February 9th, Roberts, Burke, Larry Smith, Comcast's CFO, and six of their advisors met in a conference room in the Westin Hotel in Philadelphia, across the street from Comcast's headquarters, to make a final decision. That Wednesday,